Hello.
Hello.
Hi, how are you?
You know, I'm doing all right. Having a pretty good day so far.
Yeah?
Yeah. I mean, I had some toast.
Nice.
Had some tea. Really just coming at it on all burners. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's right. And so it's like only like 9 o'clock there, right?
Yeah. It kind of, being on the West Coast, every so often feels like a time traveling superpower to me.
Oh my God,
because,
right?
Like, yeah, because like, for whatever reason, my body like wakes me up at like 6:15 in the morning, like every day.
Mm-hmm.
And then I just get a shit ton of stuff done by like 9 a.m. And I feel like I'm still in the morning while everyone else has fast traveled to the afternoon. And now I just don't know what to do with it. I've gotten so much accomplished.
Yeah.
It's not even 9 a.m. my time yet.
Yeah. How long have you been living there now?
A little less than 2 years. We moved here October 2014.
Okay.
Sure. Whatever less than 2 years ago was.
Yeah. I think that's right. And you were on the East Coast before that, or?
Yeah. So I was born in West Virginia, and then like the farthest west I had gone before moving to California is I went to school in Oklahoma. But then I lived in Ohio for like 6 or 7 years. So I was mostly East Coast before now.
Yeah. Yeah. So how did you decide to like just move out west? Because that's like a pretty big trip.
Well, I mean, really, it just came down to like being primarily focused on podcasting. Like, mm-hmm. It's the weirdest thing because you can podcast from anywhere. Like, I was in Ohio, Griffin was in Austin, Justin was in West Virginia, and we were doing My Brother and Me from anywhere. But for some reason, I think because most people who podcast would not call themselves podcasters.
Yeah.
They're like comedians and actors and performers and whatever. And also they happen to have a podcast. So most people record in Los Angeles, and like they really only want guests that are like there in the
room.
Yeah. And so like we weren't guesting on anybody's podcasts. We weren't like making any kind of connections. And so like I moved to LA mostly because like I had the opportunity, like there was nothing stopping me from doing it. And I was just like, yeah, I think that'll be fun for 2 years. So like my wife and I moved here to say like, I don't know, let's see how it goes. And then we're going to take stock once the 2 year time limit is up and see where we're at. But mostly it was just like, I could. So I did.
Yeah, that's great. That's awesome. And so I guess like that 2 year thing is coming up then. So do you think you'll stay?
I mean, probably not. Mostly because a little bit of cost of living.
Mm-hmm.
It's like we made the realization that like we could move back to Cincinnati. And I'm not saying we've locked in on this. This is just a conversation we've had a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Where like, for example, we can move back to Cincinnati, buy a house, pay a mortgage, and fly back to Los Angeles once a month.
Yeah.
And still be spending less than we're spending on our 2-bedroom apartment.
Oh my God.
You know what I mean? Like, that to me was like, oh yeah. Like, yeah. I could be in LA 5 days a month and like record with people and do a thing and like still save like $300 more than I'm doing now a month. So,
yeah.
That's... It's kind of hard to justify when you have, like a real job that you have to like drive to and be at.
Yeah.
And be like, yeah, there's nothing keeping me here and I'm spending a shit ton of money to be here.
Yeah, no, for real. I mean, I'm in Toronto and it's not the most expensive city in Canada. I think Vancouver still has that crown, but it is very expensive. And it's just like, I don't have a job where I have to be somewhere.
Yeah.
And I don't really like... I mean, I like living in a city, but I don't like go out that much. And so it's like,
I have that thought. Like, we've been looking at like different cities to move to, and it's, oh God, it's the lamest shit. But when you're like, what do I look for in a city? And Teresa and I were like, we don't really like go to museums. We don't like go to the opera. We don't like, What is the thing that would draw us to a city? And I think it just comes down to like where we know people and where we're close to things. But like, I wish I was like the kind of metropolitan, like cool kid that was like, well, it's got a really great art scene, but I'm not that. I'd be like, oh yeah, art's great, I guess. Like, that's as far as I would go with it. And I'm pretty, I was about to say one of the worst sentences I've ever said in my life. I'm pretty cultured, I guess. but, like, that idea of, like, because, you know, I did theater forever.
Yeah,
theater kid from way back. But, like, there's pretty much theater, surprisingly, for most people, like, everywhere.
Yeah.
Even if it's, like, community theater, like, children's theater or something. Like, I don't know of most cities with 100,000 people or more that don't have some kind of theater in it.
Mm-hmm.
So that idea of like, well, I want to go somewhere where there's theater. Like, okay, cool. Throw a dart. like, we looked at DC. We've looked at Chicago. We looked at like Kansas City. We've looked at all of these. Are you originally from Canada?
Yeah. I'm from like a city called Hamilton, which is like about an hour outside of Toronto.
Okay. So was it a big jump for you to go from Hamilton to Toronto, or was there a bunch of other stuff in between that?
Not really. I mean, so, like, I moved here for college, like, 10 years ago, and then I actually did live in the States for a while, so I sort of made, like, a big jump out west, too, so kind of sight unseen.
Did we kick you out?
Yeah. I was in grad school, and then I left grad school, and they don't like you to stay around after you do that.
Wait, is that real? Oh, I was kidding. Were they really like, your visa is expired, get out?
Yeah, basically.
It's always crazy when I hear that, like, happen to Canadians. This is not a thing I expect. I expect the border between Canada and America to just be so fluid.
Yeah.
It's just like, whatever, stay, we don't care. Whatever.
Right, that's, I think, the perception. But yeah, it is still actually very harsh. So, yeah, I moved back here, like, about 3 years ago. And I'm actually looking at moving to New York right now, which is, like, a whole other level of, like, oh my god, like, the amount of rent I'm going to be paying just to live in this place. I've got to, like, make the most of it if I'm actually going to live there.
I would say the thing... I think this is true of both New York and Los Angeles. The thing that I think is most intoxicating about living in Los Angeles is just the overwhelming possibility.
Mm.
Just like the feeling of like, if I want to do a thing, like there's always a big name concert. There's always some kind of weird like installation at a museum. There's always some kind of like, go check out this house where so-and-so was murdered. Like there's like across the board, no matter what your interest is that day, like, do you want to go to a place where they make the hot dog right there at your table? Like, that kind of thing exists everywhere here. But that's also when you and your wife are homebodies, which me and my wife are a little bit, more so now than we used to be. But, like, when it's just like, yeah, there's all this possibility, and we are doing none of it. I mean, we just went to the Magic Castle. And the Harry Castle? Potter. Oh, Merritt. The Magic Castle. It's a dream. It's a dream for 12-year-old Travis.
Okay.
So basically, the Magic Castle is the clubhouse for magicians.
Wow.
And, like, you have to be either a member or be a guest of a member to get in.
Yeah. Is this on an episode of Arrested Development?
Yeah. It's based on that.
Yeah.
And so, basically, it is... There's, like, a dining room. There's, like, 18 bars in the place. And there's also, like, eight. I didn't even get to fully explore the place. Like, performing spaces where there are people doing magic, like, really good magic all the time. And because, like, it's exclusive and there's, like, a dress code and it's fancy as shit, like, you don't ever feel, like, touristy. You really feel like you're in... something special, like you're doing something very magical. And it is, like, from the word go, as you like walk in, you come in through a secret bookcase door. Like, they've really set it up to be like, this is some real ass shit. And so did that, and also in the same week went to the Wizarding World of Harry Potter. So, like, we had a week full of like, here's your like full-on possibility, you know, Hollywood experience. It was pretty magical weekend, I'm not gonna lie. Like,
yeah, wow. I mean, yeah, it's really nice to... That's, I think for me, it's like, it's nice to live somewhere where I'm like, well, I could do all these things if I ever wanted to, and occasionally I will. And, like, not being in a place like that, like, I would probably just start to, like, get bored. Or just, yeah, that sense of possibility, I think, is really important.
But I've also heard from people about New York that, like, and I've never lived there, but I've also heard that, like, it's amazing how, like, the biggest city will become, like, your radius of, like, 12 blocks around where you live. Yeah. And then, like, that's kind of your version of New York. And then when people come to visit you and want to, like, go to other places in New York, they're like, oh, I never go there.
Yeah.
Like, how quickly it becomes, like, I think of New York as this one area because that's where I live.
Yeah, I think that's totally true. And, like, the transit situation there, like, I mean, I love the subway, but it is weird. Like, getting to some places can be this weird adventure of, like, going to a different borough to get to somewhere in your own borough.
Yeah.
And it's just, like, this weird thing. And I know a lot of people who, like, yeah, exactly have that. Like, they have their, like, little neighborhood, and it's, like, that's it, right?
Well, and even here in LA, like, I had to really slide my scale of, like, the time it takes to get to places. Because, like, when I was in Cincinnati, you know, we were in a, you know, far away from downtown neighborhood, and it was, like, a 10-minute drive to get downtown.
Yeah.
And now in LA, like, it's not out of the question for, like, a round trip to take an hour and a half to 2 hours to, like, to get somewhere and get back. And so it's, like, that's ridiculous in any other context. Like, I could drive from Cincinnati to Indianapolis in, like, an hour and a half. And it takes me about that long at 5 o'clock to get from my apartment to downtown. You know what I mean? Like, I've ridden on a subway to get from, like, JFK to Queens and had it take 2 hours. Like, the flight was 4.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you just get used to it. Brent, who does trends like these with me, lives in New York. But, like, when he was in grad school, he would tell me about, like, getting on a subway and, like, every day to get to grad school and it taking him, like, an hour and 45 minutes. And he was like, well, a lot of that's walking and stuff. And I was like, every day of the, like, Monday through Friday, hour and 45 minutes there, hour and 45 minutes back.
Oh, my God.
That's crazy.
Yeah, it's so funny, like, the different things that people just, like, accept as normal, like, the different kind of distances and scales, right?
Yeah, because they're just like, that's how long it takes. Like, you just get used to, like, yep, that's factually correct. And then you end up being the D-bag that, like, when you go back to visit your friends in a smaller town, you're like, it only takes 10 minutes? This is crazy!
Yeah, I mean, I was in England last fall, and I was, like, taking the train around a lot, and people were like, oh, it's like a 5-hour train ride. You don't want to take the train up north. And I was like, 5 hours? Like, it takes me 12 hours on the train to get to New York from Toronto. Like, your country is tiny. I can, like,
not only that, but I bet it's prettier.
Oh, yeah. No, it's way nicer. Taking a train in England is, like, there's, like, sheep and, like, rolling hills and, like, fog. And
I just love that you started with sheep. Like, sheep. It's gorgeous.
It's the sheep. You wouldn't believe. No,
I believe you, because we went to Scotland for our honeymoon, and, like, it, when we were, like, in the Highlands, like, we were in Scotland, and it was, like, I could have driven constantly. Like, it took, you know, it's because everything is so spread out in the Highlands, like, it was, like, you know, half hour to get to everything that we did, but at no point was it, like, ugh, well, this is taking forever. It's, like, literally, it was just sheep everywhere. It was beautiful.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, and also, like, terrifyingly small roads. That was also a thing.
But. Yeah, yeah, definitely. If you're used to driving on American roads, it's like, is this going to fit? But yeah, like, I was talking to someone who had done, like, the longest distance that you can go in Britain from, like, the south end to the north end. Mm-hmm. And I was, like, figuring it out because I took a train to Winnipeg one time. And I was like, that is not even all the way to Winnipeg. Like, it's I took, like, a 36-hour train out to the middle of Canada, and I'm like, the longest distance in the UK is, like, still, like, it wouldn't even get you all the way there. So, like, yeah, I kind of, like, just, I was really tempted to move there, because I'm like, I just feel like I could go anywhere, like, and at any
time.
It's just
so condensed.
Yeah. Kind of.
I don't know. Sometimes I think about that, like, as far as our states go. I don't know why this thought popped into my head the other day, but I was thinking about, like, the states of America. And, like, how crazy big our country really is compared to like the fact that like some of our states could hold like 8 countries in them. And like that's just a thing that we all accept is true. And then when you start talking about how difficult it is to like govern America, and like when we are in the middle of elections and you're talking about, well, this person did really well in this state and this person did really well in this, and you're like, yeah, they're the size of their own country. Of course it's different from state to state. Our shit is gigantic.
Yeah, it's like real big.
But we all just like accept that. It's like, but this is our country. It's like, yeah, but it's huge. It's completely unmanageable.
Yeah, it's a miracle anything gets done.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah, I actually, Canada is like, I mean, we don't have nearly as many people, but it's, you know, even bigger. And like, but I saw this this picture the other day that just had a line drawn across, like horizontally across like the very, very lower edge of Canada, like just catching Toronto. Mm-hmm. And it was like 50% of Canadians live below this line.
Oh, wow.
So like most of us live very, very close to the US. And then there's all this space that like people live in, but the population density is like so much less.
I bet that's to some degree, I bet that's true in America. Cause I know like Montana and like your Dakotas and there's like a whole kind of semicircle area where it's just like, if you cut out around like, if basically I think if you cut a semicircle that just like brushed against California and like Illinois, in that semicircle, you probably have very, very little population density. Which is, and then you go to New York and you see everyone crowded together and you're like, you know, there's like 8 states you guys will be in.
Yeah. It does seem kind of silly sometimes. Yeah.
But anyway, I get it, because you get drawn to the places where things are, like, especially when it comes to work. That's the thing. It's like podcasting is not really a job that like makes me be anywhere in particular to work. Mm-hmm. But like, if you wanted to, like, somebody asked me the other day, like, what I thought about Los Angeles. And I was like, it's like if there was a restaurant that served your favorite meal, like, you couldn't get that meal anywhere else, but the service was terrible and the place was filthy and there was always a line to get in and it was like hard to find parking. Like, that's Los Angeles. Like, if the thing you want to do is like work in film and television or like any kind of like creative, you know, production, and you're anywhere else, like, I feel like you're really kind of, of course you can do it from a lot of different places. People are doing it all over the country. And I'm not saying that, but I'm like, this is the mecca of that. This is the like place that you go when you really want to like take it to the next level. And so if I was doing that, I don't know that you could pry me away from Los Angeles, because it's a really, as someone who like really likes working on creative projects and doing shit, it's really nice to be in a city where like, if I say I had an idea for a thing, like 10 people turn around and they're like, tell me about it. Like, that's really great. It's really nice and really makes you feel, even if it's completely superficial, really makes you feel like everyone's kind of like interested in hearing your idea, because maybe it's an idea that they could like collaborate with you on or be a part of. But at the very least, it's better than like being surrounded by people going, okay, what is it this time? You know? And so like that part is great. Yeah. It's all the infrastructure stuff that's terrible.
Yeah, no, that is what I've heard. And it does seem, like that would be kind of like an intoxicating space to be in, of just, I've had that experience in New York as well, of just feeling like, anytime you have an idea, or like there's always people who would want to work with you, or there's always other people doing cool things. And it seems like you've started or like launched all these different things since you've been there, which is really cool.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure I don't keep good track of anything ever, but I'm pretty sure that when I moved here, I was just doing My Brother and Me. And now that I've been here, I'm doing like 8 different shows, I think.
Yeah, it's
a lot. I'd be doing more if my wife left me. Yeah, she won't let me do anymore. But
yeah, well, that seems like, like a lot.
I keep having more ideas for podcasts, but I don't think legally I'm allowed to do more.
So. You've hit the cap, yeah.
Yeah, I'm at maximum capacity until I cut some so I can do new ones.
But like, yeah, that's yeah, like that's your thing, right? Like it's, I mean, I think some people are like, that seems like a lot of podcasts, but it's like, if that's what you do, then.
Yeah, I don't do anything else.
Right.
It's not like I have to do 8 podcasts and my day job.
Yeah.
Like that is my day job and it is work. Like,
oh yeah.
I remember I lived with Griffin in Cincinnati when he had first graduated college and he was working for Joystick at the time. And I used to just like, oh, I as you might imagine an older brother doing was like, oh, you all you do is play video games all day. You're so lucky. And I gotta go to work and you sit there and play video games. And then once I actually lived with them and saw like what it looks like when you play video games for a living, that's like, oh yeah, you gotta do that like 8 to 10 hours, sometimes more, because like you've just got a copy of the game and the embargo lifts in 12 mm-hmm. hours and you gotta beat it so you can write the review and it's not even fun for you anymore. And then you post a review and like 1,000 people are telling you how terrible you are because you said that you didn't like all of that, where it's just like, oh yeah, you're not doing it for fun and getting money.
Yeah.
Like, you're doing it because it's your job. And so like I have 8 podcasts and it's my job. That I do like 8 to 10 hours a day. And like Wednesdays, from I have a light Wednesday today, but normally Wednesdays, I'm working from 6 a.m. till 10 p.m. getting everything ready because I have like 3 shows that go up on Thursday. And like I do it because I really love doing it. And also it's fun, but I mostly do it because it's my job, because it's how I make money, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's like, it still feels hard to explain that stuff to people sometimes. Like, I mean, and I just have sort of like the one show right now, but it is like a fair amount of my income comes from it. Mm-hmm. And when people ask, like, what do you do? And I'm like, oh, I host this podcast. And it's like, I feel like I need, like, I was talking to you about this on Twitter the other day. Like, I feel like I need business cards because that kind of like legitimizes it as like a real thing.
Yeah, because I feel like, and I don't get this as much now. Well, when I first started doing the podcast, and even for like the first 4 years of my brother and me, I would say I had a podcast like when I met someone new and they would be like, I do too. Or like, so does my cousin.
Yeah.
And I'd be like, oh, what's yours? What's theirs? And it was just like something that was like not a good concept or not something that was viable. It was just like, I just do impressions and I record it. And it's just like, okay. Cool. Because, and it's such a double-edged sword, because it's one of the things I love most about podcasts and also hate most. Mm-hmm. And I talk about this anytime I talk about podcasts, but like the most beautiful thing about podcasts is anyone can do it. When we started my brother and me, I had like a $10 headset, you know, combination headphone microphone from Walmart. Griffin was using the microphone from Rock Band. Like, we were not like rolling in high tech money, you know what I mean? And so anyone can start a podcast. If you have a concept and you have like $15, you can start a podcast. But the other side of that is that means anybody can have a podcast. So you ain't special for having a podcast. Now having 8, I feel pretty special.
Yeah, that's but, a little different.
Yeah, but I always feel like there has to be a comma in the middle of the sentence, I have a podcast, and the second half of it has to be, and I do it professionally, like, full-time, it's how I make my living, it's real, I swear.
Yeah.
You know, like, it helps being in L.A., because I think L.A., everyone kind of has a bit of more of a finger on the pulse of, like, podcasts are, like, either the next big thing or the current big thing.
Yeah.
So when I say I have a podcast, it's not met with like, what's a podcast? It's like met with like, are you on a network? Oh, do you like, how do you, where do you, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Where like people are at least well-versed in it enough that they treat it like it's a viable product, which is nice. But even then it's still like, people are like, oh, like Chris Hardwick. And I'm like, no one's like Chris Hardwick, but thank you.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it is. It's funny how I guess, yeah, more people are on board with that stuff lately. And I guess probably in LA it would be better. And here it's like, you know, I'll tell people that sometimes and they're like, oh, okay, that seems. And then I always try and do the thing where I'm like, and here are the semi-famous guests I've had, like, because that's sort of a legitimacy play. Like, I'm like, oh, I had my friend Mara Wilson on, or oh, I had like, you know, all these people, and people are like, oh, that sounds like you're kind of doing something semi-serious, I guess.
Yeah. Well, especially when, like my brother and me, we don't really have guests. I think we've had, like, 7 in 300 episodes.
Yeah.
And, like, there's kind of a, one of my favorite jokes from this guys that do Stop Podcasting Yourself, Dave Shumka and Graham Clark, mm-hmm. is they have a joke that, like, we started our podcast before podcast needed a concept.
Yeah.
And, like, my brother, we have a concept. We do, like, you know, mm-hmm. bad advice. We do, like, we're unqualified to give advice. But it's not really a great description. Like, you can describe Welcome to Night Vale really well. Sure. You can describe Thrilling Adventure Hour really well. You can describe Serial really well. And then people are like, what's your podcast? And I'm like, well, it's me and my brothers. And people ask us for advice, but we're not qualified to give advice, so it's silly. And, like, it just sounds, like, until I actually make someone listen to it, it just sounds so bad. Like, on paper, it sounds so dumb.
Right.
And it's so hard to be like, I know that sounds stupid, but people really like it.
Yeah. No, that's tough. I mean, but some of your other shows, I feel like, have a better elevator pitch. Like Schmanners is like, that is like a concise thing that, like, oh yeah, this is like a concept that people can understand really quickly, right?
Yeah. And I mean, it was mostly because when we started doing my brother and me, we had no idea what we were doing.
Yeah.
And I didn't start another podcast for like 5 years, so when we got to the newer shows, like, I really knew what I was doing, at least like a lot better than I did when I started at MBNB AM. So, like, with Schmanners, I was like, okay, how do we pitch it to people so that they're interested right away? So to be able to say, like, it's a show about how etiquette still applies in the modern world. Okay, cool. That's like a great one sentence, concise thing. Trends Like These. It's a show where we take the stories that are trending on Facebook and we read beyond the headlines. Okay, great. Perfect. Bunker Buddies. It's a show about surviving the apocalypse with two people who don't know how to survive the apocalypse. Okay, great. Perfect. You know, like that kind of, Can I Pet Your Dog? It's a completely enthusiastic, unironic show about how much we love dogs. Okay, great. Like that kind of thing. Like, yeah. I got a lot better, except for Till Death Do Us Part. That's the one that's really hard to explain.
Yeah, it's an annual show about Paul Blart Mall Cop 2.
Correct.
That will continue in perpetuity.
Forever. Because we've committed that when one of us dies, we'll be replaced. And the show must continue forever for the rest of linear time. Mm-hmm. Right now, it's me, Justin Griffin, and the two guys, Tim and Guy, from The Worst Idea of All Time.
Mm-hmm.
For now. I mean, who knows? And we've still put... It's my favorite, because every time I talk about the show, I get to say this. So far, we've put out one episode, last American Thanksgiving, and we're going to put up another one next American Thanksgiving, mm-hmm. forever. but that made us laugh really hard and wasn't like, that one's not meant to be as commercially viable, I guess, as the other ones. But then there's like, Interrobang, I guess, is another one that's hard to record, hard to describe, where it's like, it's me and my friend Tybee, and she and I talk about issues that we're dealing with and that the world's dealing with that frustrate us, and we're trying to make some kind of sense about it, and we're trying to create a safe place in podcast form. Like, it's a little bit harder to do in one sentence, except to say, like, I don't know, we try to be sensitive and safe, come join us. Like, it's the kind of thing that I think that, like, I've mostly said to people, like, you really need to take a listen to get an idea of what it's like. But I try to make all the shows at least enough that if somebody loved the show and wanted to tell their friend about it, they could do it without too much, like, well, I guess I should also say, well, let me explain. Like, I wanted to avoid that too much. Like, Adventure Zone is like, me and Justin and Griffin play Dungeons and Dragons with our dad, but we don't know what we're doing. Mm-hmm. Like, that kind of thing was like, okay, that's a pretty good, and you drop Dungeons and Dragons in there, so, like, I think you're going to be fine.
Yeah.
I think that's all the shows. I get lost in them sometimes.
There's so many. Yeah. But I've definitely had that problem when I'm like trying to explain other shows to people, like Dave and Graham's show, Spy, when I've been like, it's these two guys and they have a guest and they overhear yep. things sometimes.
and sometimes they talk about, yeah, it's so, like, I do that when I was talking with Jesse, who does George Jesse Go, the other day. Mm-hmm. And he was like, I can't describe our show to people. Like, I don't know how, because it's like, Jordan and I have a guest on, and we talk for a while. Yeah. Like, there's not really a concept past that.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of this show, too. And I don't even have the excuse of having started it, like, 6 years ago or whatever.
But I'm honestly jealous of that. Like, I was thinking about this the other day. It's like, we have guests on our show. Let's see. We've had, like, Can I Pet Your Dog has a lot of guests because we want to hear about people's dogs. Bunker Buddies, we've had guests. We just had our first guest on Trends Like These. Freddie Wong came on to talk to us about whitewashing, which was really great. Mm. But like My Brother and Me doesn't really have guests. Adventure Zone has never had a guest. Schmanners hasn't had a guest. And Tara Bang hasn't had a guest. And there's something about the idea of like, I keep meeting really awesome people that I wish I had a podcast that was just me and a guest. So I could have them on, you know what I mean? Like. I can't justify another podcast right now.
But yeah, that's the secret ulterior motive of this show is that for people who I already know and I'm already friends with, it's like a good excuse to talk to them because otherwise I don't do Skype calls with my friends that often. And for people who I don't know that well, it's like a good excuse to like get to talk to them and like, you know, get introduced, which is like, is fun. So it's like, it's great. Like, I really recommend it if you ever have like an opening for another show.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing, because it seems like it's what I do. Like, it's the best way I have to make a connection with somebody. I always look for an excuse to, like, have... Because ulterior motive's a great word for it. Because, like, one of the questions we get the most on My Brother and Me is, like, I'm an adult. How do I make friends?
Yeah.
And it's really hard.
Mm-hmm.
Because, like, I think there's something... That I don't know what age it happens at, but there's something that happens when you're a kid where when you're like six, you'll like make a friend by saying like, I like you, we're friends now. And like, you don't think twice about it.
Yeah.
And then like at some age, you become really self-conscious about telling someone that you think they're interesting and you want to be friends with them. And you start to look for, like, what's the organic way that they're going to become friends? And some of my best adult friendships have literally come from me looking at the person going, I like you, and I'm going to be your friend now. Like, when I met Tybee, who does Interrobang with me, one of our mutual friends was like, I think you guys would get along. And we sat down to have coffee, and we ended up talking for, like, 4.5 hours. And at the end of it, I was like, I think of you as like a sister already. We're going to be best friends. And like, we are now, you know what I mean? But I think most of the time everyone's looking for like, what's the opportunity for me to talk to this person again without making it seem like I wanted to talk to them again because I want to be friends, you know? And so podcast is good for that. And that kind of thing of like, this is my excuse to call you again.
Yeah, no,
like, absolutely. We never stop being awkward at dating, you know what I mean? Whether it's friends or romance or a job or anything, that feeling of like, how do I not seem like I want it while still trying to get it?
That is like such a thing in any kind of like relationship, right? And it's it sucks because it's like admitting that you want, that you have like a desire to like get to know someone is like seen as like, it can be really seen in a negative light. And it's like, wow, cool. We've set up a situation where like no one could invent anything they want. And like, that seems really good and healthy.
Right. And the thing is like, I'll tell other people this all day long, but I'll never take my own advice of like, if you want to be friends with that person and you say like, hey, I want to be friends with you. And they go like, oh, weird. Then you don't want to be friends with that person. Like, it's a really, like, it really solves the problem. Like, you know what I mean? Like, if they're that type of person, good news. You just found out that you dodged a bullet because they don't sound like the person you actually want to be friends with.
Mm-hmm.
But everyone treats it like, how do I trick this person into being my friend?
Yeah.
You know, I wish that we weren't that way. I don't know why across society, like, I don't think it's a problem with like men or women or adult, like, whether it's college or, you know, 30-year-old, 40-year-old, 50, I don't know that it's a demographic problem. I think just in general, everybody is taught, like,
keep to yourself. Don't. Okay. Cool. 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 Don't let anyone know. Don't open yourself up or you'll get hurt. Don't do that. Which is sad.
Super sad.
And like I said, I was talking with Tybee about this. Now that I'm married, it's really easy for me to like look at dating and be a real expert on it. Like now that I don't have to do it, I can really step outside of the whole situation and tell everyone what they're doing wrong. It's a little bit of the same thing with friendships. Like now I feel like I've got like 10 really best friends and like 100 pretty good friends. And I feel pretty well set for adult friendships. Mm-hmm. And so now I'm really good at telling people how to make friends.
Yeah, you won. So now you can dispense advice to other people. Yeah.
You know, once you win the gold medal in like downhill skiing, you can really tell other people how to downhill ski.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, but all that stuff just, I think, from the perspective of someone who is like kind of happy with where they are, whether it's in terms of dating or like, or friendship or whatever, like from that perspective, it just seems like absurd and ridiculous, like the things that people do.
But like when you're in it,
yeah,
like it all seems like it makes so much sense. Mm-hmm. Like the inability to like, I get it. Like I didn't realize until this only occurred to me. I've been with my wife and I were like dating and living together for like 5 years before we got married. We've been married for 2 years now. And like, I didn't realize until recently, like, oh, before that, I don't know that I was ever in a serious relationship. I definitely felt like they were serious. Mm-hmm. Like they seemed serious at the time. But now I look back on them and I'm like, I don't know that I was really participating in that in an adult, mature way. Mm-hmm. And like, but when I was in it, like, I definitely was like, yeah, this is it. I'm in love with this person. This is real. You know what I mean? But then you actually get in a committed, like happy, like long-term relationship and you're like, oh,
yeah.
Oh, okay, great. Cool.
Yeah.
You know, it's like realizing every picture you've ever taken was out of focus. And then you focus the camera and you're like, oh, shit. I just didn't know any better. I've been doing it wrong this entire time.
Yeah. Well, it's so easy to think of like the way that things are as like normal, like even if they're really dysfunctional or, you know, bad or whatever. It's like, well, this is just how things are, I guess. And then when you're out of that and in a more stable place, it's like, oh, my God, how did I ever accept that was OK?
But I think the tricky thing is then if you're in the happy position, it's also I've learned this through many, many trials and errors, is that to turn around to people who aren't in that position yet and say, like, if you want to be happy, you just need to do this. And like everyone's like, because when they're in it, they can't see it that way. And they don't want to hear you tell them about how much happier you are now that you don't worry about all the stuff that they're worried about. Mm-hmm. Because you think that would be helpful. You think that you would be helping by saying like, hey, I know that that seems important, but just let it go. And it's like, yeah, but I'm in it. I'm dealing with it. You know? And like, I try to be very positive on Twitter and try to be like, hey, everybody. And I realized the other day, months ago, I was like, hey, everybody, I hope you're having a great day. And somebody like responded to that saying like, hey, I'm like in the middle of a depression spiral and it's really hard for me to have a great day. And when you tweet that, it makes me feel bad. And on one level, like my first reaction to that was like, well, you know what I meant. I want you to. And then I was like, you know what? You're right. Because like the expectation of like make every day great is a standard that's impossible to live up to. And so like I try now to say like, I'm just glad you're having a day, whether it's great or not. And maybe tomorrow will be a great day. You know, that kind of idea of like all inclusive. The good thing is that you keep having days and then like you try to make the next one great and you're trying to make the next. But like you didn't fail. You're not doing it wrong if you're not having a great day, which is a thing that I've learned as an adult, you know. But even then, most of the time when I'm like tweeting really positive stuff or like it's because I felt something very negative, whether it's like I woke up on the wrong side of the bed or somebody said a really shitty thing to me on Facebook or Twitter, like I'm trying to rechannel that into positivity. And so my expectations for other people are not that they're 100% of the time happy, because no one is that. Like, only cartoon characters are that, and most of the time not even that. And so it's really, this is once again one of those things that's really easy for me to say and hard to tell other people to do, because if they don't have the same life experiences that get me to this position, then they haven't made the same. But like the idea of like, I decide to be happy. So when someone says something shitty to me on Twitter, I can either engage with them in an argument that lasts an hour that I think about for the next 3 days, or they say something shitty and I go on Twitter and I say, I hope everyone's having a great day. And if not, I love you and we'll get them tomorrow. And then I see all these people say like, hey, thanks, I really needed that.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, great, I'm happy now, because I decided to take the energy that I felt and redirect it towards happiness.
Yeah.
And like, but I can't then turn around to other people and say, just decide to be happy, because they're like, I don't know how to do that. If I knew how to do that, I would do it. And like, that's an unreasonable expectation for me at this. And it's like, yeah, because I have had all of these incidents and good things and bad things and stepping stones and redirection and all these things that got me to this second right now that they don't. So for me to say, just do what I do, is like, it's unreasonable, yeah, right? Because everybody has their own method of dealing with stuff. But yeah, like, I just want everyone to be happy, Merritt.
Yeah, no, but I think like, yeah, you know, like it is unfair to tell people to like, just be happy. But like, I think what you describe is like recognizing that when something bad, or like when you have like a bad feeling because someone says something shitty to you or whatever, you have a like a choice, right? Like, you don't automatically have to launch into this spiral. And I think that's the hard thing for people to recognize, is that they do have a choice there. Like, they can lean into those feelings. And like, that sometimes is what you want to do. Sometimes you want to wallow, or sometimes you want to feel those shitty feelings. But you don't have to, right? I think that's the important thing, is like, that's the skill, right? Is learning like, oh, sometimes I may want to do this and I will, but like, it's not automatic. Like, if I...
And even then, like, I don't nail it every time. The other day, I had like one too many whiskeys, because I'm 32, and now that might mean two whiskeys instead of like 18. Mm-hmm. I had like one too many, and I made a joke hanging out with some people that I kind of knew, and the joke didn't land. And the next day I woke up, and for like 2 hours, I was just like, they all think I'm stupid and the joke was dumb and I feel really bad about it and I've convinced myself. And then it was like, just stop. Like, and I had to like, in my own head, tell myself like, hey, this thing you're doing gets you nowhere. Like, you can't go back in time. Like, how about you just don't think about it anymore? And then it took me another 2 hours of repeating like, don't worry about it, before I was able to like move on with my day. Yeah. And like, but, and it's tough as shit. Like, it's hard to be happy, and it's easy to be sad. It's easy to be angry. It's easy to feel worthless. It's easy to do all that stuff, because like, it doesn't take you a lot of work to get to that place. Mm-hmm. At least for me. I don't want to speak for everybody, but when you get to a position where you're happy, which I usually find works best if I'm kind of making happiness in others, which is why I like doing so many comedy podcasts. But when I can like inspire happiness in others, it tends to make me happy. I like that reflection. Mm-hmm. But when you achieve it, it really feels like you've accomplished something. Especially the worse your day is, if you can hit a point where like you're laughing at something, or you made somebody laugh at something, like, it's such a good feeling. But it's hard. Like, it's hard. Yeah, it's actively hard to be happy sometimes.
For sure. Yeah. Like, you're pushing back against like so much stuff that says that, you know, that maybe says that things are bad, or that you're worthless, or all these different messages. And you have to like, pushing back against that is like a ton of work. And like, I think when people are able to do that at all, sometimes it's like, wow, like, that's really impressive, and I'm really proud that you're able to do that. Like, that's super cool.
And I think one of the hardest things is that there's actually a thing that happens psychologically to people where when you're in the middle of like a really bad experience, it's hard to remember a time when it wasn't happening. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to imagine that it will ever stop.
Yeah.
You know, like if you've ever been like really sick, like throwing out like the flu for like 3 days, on that third day, you're like, I've always been sick. I will always be sick. I'll never feel good again. Mm-hmm. I don't remember what it feels like to not feel sick. And then like expand that to like someone who's severely depressed or somebody who's like just been in a shame spiral for like 6 months because like they've lost their job and they, you know, they're significant other left them and like their family won't speak to them, and then to like look at them and be like, just be happy. And it's like, yeah, like you can't just do that at that point because I don't remember how to do it. And so like it's really tough to be happy. And so if you can achieve it through hard work, it feels so good. But that's the thing, is like sometimes when I like this isn't the same as that like 6 month spiral I just described, but like I got super sick over Christmas this year and it lasted like 4 weeks, and it included like my ears stuffing up and like I couldn't stop like throwing up and I couldn't sleep and all this stuff. And I just had to like keep reminding myself, like, eventually I'll feel better. Mm-hmm. Like this won't last forever. One day I'll wake up and I'll feel fine. And I had to like keep telling myself that because it just wouldn't stick in my head. It just wasn't like what my brain wanted to hear. My brain wanted to wallow on the couch, you know?
Right. Yeah.
That was all way too deep. I apologize. No. We were talking about other stuff earlier.
No. Don't apologize. That's super important stuff. And like, it's really cool for me to hear about like, because I think this is a pretty common thing for people who are like have like a really kind of positive presence on Twitter or like or elsewhere or who do comedy, is like I think what a lot of people don't realize is they often are like when I post things like that too, it's often not that I'm like, oh, I have this figured out and I'm gonna tell everyone else how to do it. It's like I'm saying this because I need to hear it. And it's easier for me to say to this to like generally to other people than it is for me to like just tell myself, right?
Yeah. And also a lot of it comes down to like, I just, you know, just before we started recording, I started reading like people being really shitty about the upcoming Ghostbusters movie, which I've talked about on a lot of podcasts now. And I was like I was like cracking my knuckles and ready to like launch into like getting into a fight with them. And then I just sit there and be like, but why? It won't feel good. Yeah. I've never finished one of those arguments and felt good about it.
Right.
So instead, why not tweet the thing that I wish someone would tweet at me of say like, hey, support people who make a fit like that. Like, that's the thing I want someone to say to me rather than me launching into like a Twitter fight with somebody whose opinion I don't care about anyways.
Yeah.
Like, so I even if the hour and a half long Twitter argument ended with them going, oh my God, you've opened my eyes. Only now do I really realize, like, great, I didn't care about your opinion to begin with. Because you seem like someone who has a completely different set of values and morals than me. So like, why, if we met at a party, I would just walk away. But for some reason here on Twitter, I feel the need to engage with you.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just, it's pointless. And it's so much better to instead start a new line of dialogue with people that's like grows out of a seed of positivity.
Yeah.
But like, and once again, I'll still fight with people on Twitter, you know, I'll still get into it, but I never feel good about it afterwards.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's like a super important thing to recognize. Like, I almost got sucked into something like that the other day, and I was just like, I had that feeling, I don't know if you get this, but like when your stomach just drops, when like someone says something to you or about you and you're like, oh, I could, this is like one of those moments where like I could push back and like, I don't know what's going to happen, but it's probably not going to end super well. Like regardless of if I come off looking good or not, I'm still going to have this like adrenaline and like, I'm going to feel like all messed up. Or I could just like, just not. Just like, just walk away.
Yeah. Just go eat a cookie and take a shower and don't worry about it.
Yeah. And I was able to do that this time. And it was like, wow, that felt really good. Yeah.
And you know what? The funny thing is, too, is I'm starting to realize, because I often talk about with people when I talk about how much I love Twitter, and I do, I really love Twitter. And people are like, oh, the internet is so scary. People are so mean. And I'm like, you know what? They're not really to me. And I used to think it was just like, guess I'm just lucky, or like people must really like my brother and me. And I'm starting to think that maybe it's like, because I don't engage with that stuff on a regular basis, and because I'm trying so hard tooth and nail to like put positivity out into Twitter, that it's just not, I'm not garnering, that my negativity is not growing more negativity. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. That like, I'm not saying that everybody who's gay, because there are people sure. who will just be shitty to someone because of who they are.
Yeah.
Or there will be people who like will hate you because you have a different opinion of them about how good Uncharted 4 is. And that will just happen because mm-hmm. there are terrible people in the world. But like Michael Ian Black, who I'm a huge fan of, seems like he's constantly in some kind of Twitter argument with somebody. And I think that that's because he engages in Twitter arguments with people.
Yeah.
So people will start Twitter arguments with him because they know that he'll engage with them.
Right. Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Where like, hey, Michael, if you're listening and you like doing that shit, awesome, man, because you're really good at it mm-hmm. and you're really good at making those people look dumb. But like, it's just not, it's not a me I like being, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's a me that gets mad and like mad to a level that is not justified by the amount of power these people actually have. You know, when someone's like, I don't want to watch a movie with four women in it, and I get like mad, and then I'm like, wait, they don't have any influence. this person has no power over mm-hmm. me. Like, they don't have any power over anyone. No one's reading that tweet and going, right. you know what? You're right. But like me engaging in an argument with them in a way validates and yeah. kind of like makes their opinion important enough that I decided, and I'm not saying because I'm me, I'm saying because anyone decided yeah. to like engage with them. Now it's like, somebody was listening and is arguing with them about it. It's like, yeah, just ignore it.
Yeah.
You know? And when someone's mean to you, just ignore it. And it's hard. And, but it feels so much better than to engage.
Yeah. Yeah. The times that I've been able to do that, yeah, it's like I come away feeling like, oh, I'm not all anxious and I'm not like sweating or like all these, like, cause it gets in your body, right? It's just mm-hmm. like this kind of like, anxious adrenaline response to like, oh, I'm fighting someone on the internet. And it's like, I think especially for people who have like a history of that stuff of like, you know, if they were like bullied in school or whatever, mm-hmm. when situations were like a lot more kind of urgent or like physical, then like even stuff like just being online can feel like that. You get that like
yeah.
fight or flight response. And it's like, actually I'm okay. Like I'm safe. Like I'm not, no one is like coming, reaching out of the screen to like, to slap me or something. Like,
yeah,
it's going to be okay.
And,
you know,
and it also is like, I also have to be clear that I realize that I'm coming from a position of privilege.
Sure.
Like I'm a straight white middle-class Protestant dude. Like there is almost no demographic I fall into that if someone says something regarding an aspect of me, that like, this is not like you have an opinion on a movie that I think is shitty. This is like, oh, you said something about a very core part of me
yeah.
that if I don't defend, if I don't say something about, I have to live with the fact that I let that one slide.
Right.
I know that.
Yeah.
Like the closest I came, I have ADD, and somebody posted a video about like how to cure ADD, and it was just somebody like slapping a kid.
Cool.
And ooh, yeah, great. And like that's the closest I've come to like, I have to say something.
Yeah.
And even then, I had that stomach dropout feeling, like the hair on the back of my neck was like raised up, my skin was crawling, and I like my teeth were clenched, and like I had this whole thing typed out. And then I took a breath and erased it, you know, because I was like, yeah, I'm mad at you and I want to do this thing, but like I won't feel good about it. And I've also tried to more recently, whenever I do want to engage with that, like the kind of like tisk tisk voice that pops in the back of my head says, when was the last time you engaged with someone positively on Twitter?
Mm.
Like you see a thing that you hate and you want to tear that person apart. But like, do you have that same impulse as often to be like, hey, that was a great joke, or like, that's an excellent point? And the answer is no. Like, I see those tweets and I'm like, okay. And I just keep scrolling.
Yeah.
But if I see something offensive, oh, I have to say something.
Yeah. Well, I've thought about that before, because like, especially on things like Twitter, where there's like a fave button or like likes now, I guess it's like, it's really easy if you see something that you like to just like and retweet it. And then if you're looking through your mentions or whatever, sometimes like the only like the actual replies you have to something are negative ones, because there's no like, I hate this button, right?
Exactly.
So that can be, yeah, I think it's really valuable and important to like actually tell people, like to use words and not just like a little star to be like, hey, that was great.
I thought that was funny. That was, and you know what? Some of my favorite people, like Paul and Storm, are really good about like, if you post a joke that they like, at least for me, because we're friends, I'll post some funny Twitter joke and they'll say like, that was a good joke, you know, and it makes me feel so nice. Like when people reply to a thing, it makes me feel so good, because it, like you're saying, they didn't just click a button. They took the time, they clicked reply, they typed in a thing, they hit send. Like we have just engaged on a thing, you know, like that feels good.
Yeah.
In a way that you're never going to get from being negative.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, unless you say something, there's a really sick burn and like 80 people are like, oh, yeah, like that feels pretty nice. I'm not going to lie. That's a pretty good feeling.
That can be good.
Yeah. That's a pretty good feeling.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
If it's a really sick burn.
Yeah. Only the sickest, though. Yeah. Yeah. I feel like I don't want to keep you all day, so I feel like we should maybe wrap things up on that note. But
okay,
this was really great. Thank you so much for being on.
Well, thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
Yeah, no problem. I would ask if there's anything you want to plug, but I know
I plugged all those shows.
I know the Bim Bam shows will be sold out if they're not already by the time this goes up. So.
I believe they are. I will plug McElroyShows.com, McElroyShows.com. You can find links to all the podcasts I talked about, plus my brother's other podcasts. I think between the three of us, we do 13 shows altogether. And you can find links to like the MBAM YouTube page and like the Monster Factory and Griffin's Amiibo Corner and all of our stuff. I would also love if you would follow me on Twitter so I can share a little positivity with them. I am at Travis McElroy.
Awesome. And you just got verified. Congrats.
I did. Oh, it feels great. It feels great, Merritt. Mm-hmm. Feels
yeah, like it really felt like they were singling you out for a while.
Yeah. And you know what? Pull back the curtain a little bit. I never received an email. Mm-hmm. I never received a heads up. I only found out I was verified because in the middle of recording one of my podcasts, somebody tweeted at me like, congratulations on the verification. And I was like, what? And like, I still to this day have no idea how it finally ended up happening.
We'll never know.
Yeah.
Thank you so much again. And I hope you have a really great day.
Thank you. You too.
Cool. I will talk to you later. Bye.
Okay, bye.
Woodland Secrets is hosted by Merritt Kopath and produced and edited by me, Nick Bravo. The podcast is made possible by funding on Patreon, where you can get access to bonus episodes of the show and other perks. Please consider supporting our work at woodlandsecrets.co/support. If you want to help people find out about the show, you can rate and review us in iTunes or tweet about the show mentioning @woodlandpodcast. Thanks for listening.